welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levone. You're bringing you an hour of horror. Later on, it's Escape from 1956, but first, Quiet Please, with a story called Rain on New Year's Eve, heard on December 31st, 1947, on the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please. Presents Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet, Please for tonight is called Rain on New Year's Eve. It's raining again. Pretty near New Year's, and it's raining again. Back east, it's probably snowing different places. Or maybe the moon's out, shining on the snow, and people are saying, why, it's so bright out you can read a newspaper. You can't read a newspaper by moonlight, only the headlines. Maybe if you take your newspaper out in the yard and stand in the moonlight, you might find a headline with my name in it. It's been there before. Well, anyway, so there's moonlight. Here there's rain, like it was that other New Year's Eve. That's what the rain makes me think of. As if I ever thought of anything else. Listen to the rain. I was sitting in my office in the writer's court out there after we'd been on the picture for 2 or 3 months. Writing it, that is. They'd been shooting for about 3 weeks, but I was still on the picture because we had a producer that couldn't make up his mind, and the director was one of those guys, sort of road company Hitchcock, you know. He makes the picture up as he goes along. Only there has to be a writer filed away someplace where he can find him when he runs out of ideas, which is not more than 11 times a day. So I'm dying. I go on the set and I find actors there I never heard of, speaking lines I never wrote in scenes I couldn't figure out. Then the director would get me in a corner and put the arm on me. This thing doesn't seem to quite gel, old man. You know? And me and my little typewriter go to work to unscrew things while the overtime and the gin rummy games go right on. Great life, that. Well, so I'm sitting in my office and the rain is on the roof and the gas heater is frying my ankles while the draft from the window is giving my neck the deep freeze. Mary Lou, my secretary, comes in from her little cubbyhole next to mine.
When do I get to do my Christmas shopping, Mr. Ramsey?
You don't get to do your Christmas shopping, Mary Lou.
Yes, I know. I didn't.
What?
Christmas was 2 days ago, Mr. Ramsey.
Was it? Well, Merry Christmas.
Are we ever going to finish this picture, for heaven's sake?
Well, I'll tell you, Angel. Mr. Doty, the great director, is getting $3,500 a week.
I know it.
And, my dear, Mr. Doty has not got $3,500 a week for a long, long time, see?
Uh-huh.
So Mr. Doty, the great director, is going to make $3,500 a week just as long as he possibly can, and characters like us can, you know what.
That man.
I have a different word for him, sweetheart. But as I was saying, if we leave it to Mr. Doty, this here picture ain't never going to be finished. 100 years from now, somebody will come upstairs here and they'll find an old, old man with a long white beard beating out the 59th revision of scene 456. And in the next room, a little apple-cheeked old lady.
Oh, cut it out.
Yeah.
Oh, when are they going to finish it? No kidding.
New Year's Eve.
Well, maybe there'll be champagne and stuff on the set.
Yeah, no doubt. For the expensive actors and the producers and the fine, upstanding director. For you and me, a nice bottle of 60-cent claret imported from right over there on Ventura Boulevard.
You're so funny.
Yeah, on the contrary.
Well, I'm getting awful sick of this, Mr. Ramsey. We've had to work every single night for the last 4 weeks. Do you realize that?
You kidding? Do I realize? Go get me some coffee, will you, kid? I gotta stay awake for Mr. Doty.
Coffee? I've it, you and I could be elected president of Brazil, all the coffee we've put away.
Answer the phone.
It's Dodie.
Well, we got to be dignified.
Oh, Lord. Mr. Ramsey's office. Who's calling, please? Oh, yes, Mr. Dodie. He's here.
I'm always here. Ramsey. Yes, Mr. Dodie. What seems to be the trouble? I see. Yes, I see, but Mr. Dodie, I... Well, that'd mean rewriting practically all of... Well, yes, I know, I mean... But what do you gain that way? What, two monsters? Well, what's two monsters got that one monster hasn't? Oh, yeah, sure, but who scares who? Whom, I mean. But, Mr. Dodie, I saw a picture once with two monsters in it, and it was silly. What? Oh, you directed it. I'll be right over. Skip the coffee, Mary Lou.
Two monsters?
Two. Count them, two. And I'll lay you 6-2, and even by the time I get to the stage, you'll be hollering for three.
Take your raincoat. It's raining pitchfork.
Maybe one of them will stab me. Better tell you about this monster stuff. This was a horror picture, you see. Kind of the poor man's Frankenstein. Yeah, they couldn't get Karloff, naturally, and they couldn't use the Frankenstein monster makeup because Jack Pierce over at Universal invented that. I guess Universal owned it. So they had me dream up a monster. And boy, did I dream one up. There's an old book. It's called... No, I guess I won't tell you what it's called. Well, you don't want to take those old books too seriously. So I kind of swiped this monster out of the book. Well, you'll never see the picture, I suppose, so maybe I better tell you a little about him. No, I guess I won't either. He was the most horrible monster I ever saw, no kidding. And what the makeup department did with my sketch and my description. Oh, boy. Just one thing I'll tell you about him, and you can figure out the rest for yourself. He didn't have any face. You take it from there. But don't kid yourself. He was a thing. They got Ollie Tharp to play the goon. Nice fella, quiet, always grinning, modest. Good actor. Last guy in the world you'd expect to play a monster. Oh, yeah, sure. Karloff did the Frankenstein thing, and he's the mildest-mannered guy in the world. I remember him on the Son of Frankenstein set years ago in his monster suit all gray and green, showing pictures of his new baby to people. That's a laugh. Well, I guess monsters are human sometimes, huh? Yeah, maybe humans are... Yeah. Well, all right. I spend 3 hours listening to Mr. Dodie run off at the mouth with the whole company having the screaming memes over all this nonsense. It's 12:05 when he finally decides to quit and everybody goes home. They're all burned at Dodie, but well, they'll wake up in the morning and remember the overtime and they'll feel better. Me? Writers don't get overtime. So I get back to the writer's court and the light's burning in the window and Mary Lou is snoring away with her face in a stack of carbon paper. She wakes up and asks me a question.
How many monsters now?
We got 4 now. See? Including me. So the next morning it's not raining anymore. The sun is shining bright. And you can see snow on top of the mountains, and it's a very nice day. And monsters are pretty hazy in my mind as I pick up my copy of the reporter and head for the rickety stairway to my palatial office. I'll tell you how much good the sunshine did me. I was whistling as I climbed up the stairs and opened the door.
You might as well turn off the whistle. Mr. Dodie's looking for you.
And now what?
He says it's very important.
Yeah, 2 more monsters.
Your coffee's on your desk.
Steaming cold, no doubt.
I've just brought it up. Give me 15 cents.
Well, it's your turn to buy this morning.
I bought yesterday.
All right, all right. Hello? No, he isn't here yet. Ah, go ahead.
Mr. Ramsey's office. Yes, Mr. Doty.
Morning, Mr. Doty. How are you? Oh? No kidding. Why, that's fine. What? Oh, of course. Yuck. Yeah, sure.
What's up?
Why, sure, Mr. Doty. Yes, sir, I'll be right over.
What?
He has to finish the picture definitely by 12 midnight December 31st.
Oh, that's what you said last night.
Well, I was kidding. You know how it goes in the story.
I forgot.
Well, I mean the way it was originally. You know, this monster only has power the last hour of the year.
Oh, yes.
Remember, it was a New Year's party, the whole picture?
It's been so long ago, I forgot how we started.
Well, don't you remember our big payoff scene? She thinks the monster is her wicked uncle.
Who thinks?
You know, the babe with the teeth. The groom girl with a blue dress.
Oh, yes.
Remember, she thinks the monster is her uncle, and she tries to rip his mask off, and it ain't a mask?
Something like that.
And the house is on fire, and he grabs her and runs inside the house, and our hero busts in after her and rescues her. Some way I never had a chance to figure out.
But how would he do it without his glasses? He'd fall over the stoop.
What stoop? There's hundreds of them in pictures.
Drink your coffee and go see Mr. Doty. Maybe he's changed his mind.
I can't change his mind. The front office put the big fat arm on him. Or else. Whoopee, baby, 3 days and we can sit down and rest.
Away from this place.
You can say that again. Tell him I ain't here. Well, sir, that sunshine looked better than ever to me. But when the big door of the stage swung shut behind me, the sunshine sure disappeared. Well, Mr. Doty was an unhappy man. Well, 3 more days and there wouldn't be any more of those $3,500 is. And he didn't like it a little bit. And guess who he took it out on?
This is the worst story I ever had to work with. It positively smells bad.
I didn't say. It's your story, Mr. Doty. All I got left is a monster, and he'll probably turn out to be Santa Claus or somebody.
You listened to me when I told you how to do it.
I didn't say. I listened to you, Mr. Doty, and now look what we got.
Now I have to give up my beautiful idea of having 3 monsters instead of one.
Because then we'd have had to reshoot practically the whole picture, and you'd have made another $1 million. I didn't say that either.
So, if you think you could possibly dredge up your original script, I think I can possibly make it into an acceptable B picture. Although that's a task even for a director like me.
Mr. Doty doesn't realize what an unconscious humorist he is. That guy could make a B picture out of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Even if he had the original cast.
So get to work. Get to work and do something. Have I got to do everything around here? Get a move on you.
Oh, I got a move on me. Even if you think I disliked that guy up to now. What? He's had to be the last 2 days.
You've got to get some sleep somehow. You've been on your feet for almost 2 days, Mr. Ramsey.
Yeah. Where were we?
Scene 168. Long shot interior match and night. From the top of the stairway, a figure appears indistinct in the shadows. We sense, rather than see, the twisted evil form of the monster as he peers over the baluster. From the foreground right, the butler appears and starts slowly up the stairway. As he reaches the fourth or fifth step, the camera starts to move in to follow him. We cram up the stairs and the camera holds on the last 3 steps as the butler reaches the top. Cut to... Hey, wake up!
I'm sorry. Where were we?
Ramsey, you've got to get some sleep. Lie down for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'd sure like to.
Mr. Ramsey's office.
I'm not here.
Yes, Mr. Doty.
All right. Hello? Yes? Sure. I'll be right over.
Oh, Mr. Ramsey, I was...
You know what, Mary Lou?
Well, put on your coat. It's raining again.
You know what?
What?
I wish I was a monster. You know, I was a tired little fellow. I didn't have any Thanksgiving. I ate a bent ham sandwich in my office that day because Mr. Doty had to have 3 new scenes Friday morning. He called me at the office to see how I was doing. He'd just finished his Thanksgiving dinner. I didn't have any Christmas. I locked the door of my office and baked my brains out on a whole new sequence Mr. Doty had thought up. All around me, people were drinking whiskey and chasing each other through the corridors and up and down the stairs. I didn't have any Sundays, and I didn't have any evenings. I, my friend, damn near lost my mind. All the time, Mr. Doty. Wow. It's no wonder that by New Year's Eve I was ready to hire a man with a cleaver to extirpate the guy. But I didn't. Nope, I sure didn't. At 9 o'clock, he called me over to the set again. Could I rewrite some dialogue? Well, I crossed him up on that one. I threw out the hash he'd made of my original dialogue and substituted what I'd originally written. It played okay. After 7 different takes, all exactly alike. I went back to my office in the rain.
Mr. Ramsey's office. Yes, Mr. Doty. Yes, Mr. Doty. I'll tell him. Mr. Ramsey.
I heard you.
He needs you right away again.
Okay, okay.
You poor thing.
Only another couple of hours. Hope I can take it.
Take your raincoat. It's raining cats and dogs.
You're telling me. That time it was a little piece of action he couldn't get through his ivory head. I explained it in words of one syllable, carefully avoiding the 4-letter one. He thanked me, old boy. And I went out into the rain again. Rain. What rain in California can do to you? I heard of a fellow that jumped into the Los Angeles River once after a week of rain. Ordinarily, he'd break his ankle, but he drowned. You know, it just comes down steadily. Well, I know I could probably be a lot more graphic than that, but that's all there is to rain in California. It comes down steadily. Ice cold. Steadily. Yeah. Of course, it always stops about the time you've decided to start out on foot for the east. The sun shines and poinsettias bloom and the hills are green. Oh, man, it's wonderful. I guess they have the rain like hitting yourself on the head with a hammer. It feels so good when you stop. Yeah, that's a bum gag, but I was a pretty beat-up character. 3 more times that New Year's Eve, in the rain. The guy getting meaner and meaner each time. Well, at least it was going to be over pretty soon. It was 10 minutes to 11 when I came into the office and Mary Lou took my coat from me.
You've just got to get a little sleep, Ramsey. Now, you sit down at your desk and put your head down and catch 40 winks.
Thanks, Mary Lou. If I had to see that man just one more time tonight, be responsible. I'm not kidding.
I know. You go to sleep.
Well, kid, you're as all in as I am.
Well, at least I don't have to face him.
He's got to stop at midnight. As soon as he's through, should you and me go someplace and have a New Year's drink?
I don't know whether I could keep awake.
Well, let's try, huh?
Okay.
Anybody ever tell you you're a nice gal?
Couple of people.
I could marry a gal like you.
Don't kid people, Ramsey.
I'm not.
See how you feel when you wake up.
I think I love you.
I wish you meant that, Ramsey.
I do. Kiss a friend goodnight.
Ramsey, you're sweet. Go to sleep.
So I went to sleep. And I dreamed. Even when I was asleep, I couldn't get that guy Doty off my mind. I dreamed I was on the set. I dreamed they were shooting the last scene, the one where the monster comes closer and closer to the camera till that head of his without any face fills the whole screen. You know how it is in dreams. You're here. And then all of a sudden you're there, and you're one guy, and then you're another, and it's all mixed up. Yeah. I could see the sep, and I could hear Dodie call out.
What? Roland! Action!
Then I could see this faceless monster coming out of the shadows. Slowly, slowly, right up to the camera where George Robinson was standing, as tired as everybody else. Then I thought to myself, if the audience had any idea that little old milquetoast Ollie Tharp was inside that monster rig, they'd bust. And in the dream, I saw Dodie jumping up and down in one of those silly rages of his, and he yelled,
"Come on, come on! Get back there, fight over! You've got about as much minute as Ramsey over there."
Even in my dreams, he was picking on me. And so they started all over again. My dream got kind of mixed up all right there, and I sort of seemed to be following the monster, because I could see Dodie's face right in front of me as the monster moved in. When Dodie yelled, "Cut again," the monster and I didn't stop. I just sort of seemed to follow him right on, farther and farther. I saw the monster's big, hairy hands grab Dodie, and Dodie screamed, and the monster's hands were fumbling at Dodie's neck. Dodie was fighting, and I saw Dodie bite the monster's hand. It was so real, I could almost feel it. And then everything got black in my dream, and there were a lot of bells ringing, and that's what woke me up. So I raised my head, and of course, there I was in my office. And I pulled myself out of it a little, and I knew what the bells were. They were bells ringing in the new year. The rain was hammering on the roof, and it was tomorrow. So I got up and hollered for Mary Lou. "Mary Lou! Hey, Happy New Year, Mary Lou!" And she didn't answer. I stepped through the door into her little office. And she was lying on the floor behind her desk. And the look on her face was something I never want to see again. It was the look of the most awful horror anybody could imagine. The kind of look you'd expect to see on the face of someone who'd been literally frightened to death by a monster who had no face at all. So I stood there. After a few seconds, I heard people yelling outside, and I heard somebody yell that Ollie Tharp had killed Dodie. Somebody else said, no, Ollie Tharp was dead too, with a broken neck in his dressing room. And my hand hurt. When I raised my hand to look at it, right across the thick of my palm were teeth marks. Deep, bloody teeth marks where Dodie had bit me when I strangled him. So you see, that's why I say never take any of those old books too seriously. Remember I said I wished I was a monster? Remember what the book said? The monster only possessed his murderous power for 1 hour, the last hour of the year. New Year's Eve again, and it's raining. Got anybody you want murdered?
Quiet, Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper. The man who spoke to you was Ernest Chappell.
And Muriel Kirkland was Mary Lou. Pat O'Malley was Dodie. Music for Quiet, Please is composed and played by Albert Berman. Now, for a word about next week's Quiet, Please, here is our writer-director, my good friend, Willis Cooper.
I have a story for you next week about a man who was haunted. It's called The Little Visitor.
And so, until next week at this time, I am quietly yours, Ernest Chappell.
Quiet, Please comes to you from New York. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Quiet, Please, on Tuned to Yesterday from December 31st, 1947 on the Mutual Broadcasting System. The star of that show, Ernest Chappell, at the same time was also the announcer for the NBC program The Big Story, taking true stories of journalistic heroes and dramatizing them on the air. And as it turns out, The Big Story and Quiet Please were the only two shows he worked for at the time, and they both happened to be broadcast on the same day. Although many hard-working radio actors had different appointments throughout the week on different networks, Ernest Chappell was probably the busiest among them on Wednesdays. You are listening to An Hour of Horror on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. Now time for Escape with the story The Abominable Snowman, a CBS episode from September 13, 1956.
Tired of the everyday grind? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all? We offer you Escape.
Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
You are high on the frozen slopes of a great mountain, terrified and caught in a blizzard. While the thing for which you've been hunting has suddenly become the hunter. And if it finds you, then for you and your companions, there can be no escape.
So listen now as Escape brings you Anthony Ellis's exciting story, The Abominable Snowman.
The first bit of luck was when we hired our Sherpa guide, Nasang. That was in Darjeeling. When I told Nasang what we were after, he hesitated for a moment. And then he said,
"The Sahibs have not come to climb Shomolungma?"
"Oh, no. We're a little late for that. It's already been done. The other two Sahibs and myself are here for the reason I told you."
"Meto Kangmi?"
"That's right."
"The Sahibs always hire me to climb the mountain with them, but never this."
"Are you afraid of them?"
"I have seen one."
"You've seen one?"
"Yes, many of us have seen them."
Wait a minute. Alan.
"Yeah, what's that?"
"I'm interviewing a Sherpa in here. He says he's seen one of the things."
"Hey.
Where's Frank?"
"Went out to get some tobacco."
"Yeah. All right, come on in. I think this is our man."
"All right."
"Nasang. This is Mr. Ferris."
"Sahib?"
"Hello, Nasang."
"Nasang was telling me about what he'd seen. Go ahead, Nasang."
"It has a face that is evil. And when it saw me, it uttered a strange cry and bounded away, sometimes leaping, sometimes running with great strides. It was dusk, and after a moment I lost sight of it in the snow."
"Where were you?"
"With the French expedition. It was at 19,000 feet. On Shomolungma."
"How far were you from it?"
30 feet, perhaps 35.
"You're sure it wasn't an ape?"
"I am sure. There is no ape in the Himalaya to make such a track."
"What about bears?"
"This too I have been asked. But does a bear walk always upon its hind legs?"
"Well, that's enough for me. Alan?"
"Yeah, he'll do."
"Yeah. But if you want the job, Nasang, you're hired."
"You are going to try to capture a Yeti?"
"Yes."
"It will be a difficult thing, but I will serve with you."
Yeti, Wild Man, Neto Kangmi, Abominable Snowman. That's the name the natives had for the things, and Alan Ferris, Frank Davis, and I were going to try to get one. We'd all done some climbing, but climbing was secondary here. Expeditions since the beginning of the 20th century had heard of the abominable snowman, observed their tracks, and one or two white men claimed to have seen them. Great ape, bear, monkey, Wild men? We didn't know. But we were going to find out. Four weeks later, we were in the Rongbuk Valley for our interview at the monastery with the Lama. The journey from our base had been uneventful. The weather was good and our spirits were high. From the Lama's window, we could see the great peak of Everest in the distance.
Why, gentlemen, do you desire to capture Metokangmi?
Because, sir, we believe it will be an invaluable aid in our prehistoric research. That is, if these things are in any way human.
And for this reason, then, you have formed the expedition?
Yes.
You are all familiar with climbing?
Yes, we are.
You would need to be. The Yeti move at high places, dangerous places, so my people tell me. Also, the monsoons are arriving in a short time.
I understand that. Then do we have your permission to investigate in the valley and beyond?
You have my permission.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate it.
There is one point, however. I must request that no wild animal or being in this valley be shot. Our religion does not allow it.
We'll respect your wishes, sir. Now, may I ask you one more thing?
Of course, my son.
Do you believe in the existence of Metokangmi?
I myself have never seen them, but I know that they live here, above the valley, on the goddess mother of the world. It is also true that at least five, and possibly more, inhabit the upper Rongbuk and its glaciers.
Thank you.
Do you have porters?
Our guide, Nasang, is hiring them now.
Yeah. I trust that he meets with good fortune.
The old man, with great dignity, bowed slightly to us and we were dismissed. But I thought I saw the shadow of a smile on his lips as he turned away. And it wasn't long before I found out why. Nasang returned to us in our quarters and his face warned of bad news.
Sir, I am unable to hire any porters.
Why not?
They know the purpose of the expedition. They will not go.
Why?
They are afraid.
Of the snowmen?
Yes. They live in peace with them. They wish no trouble. They are afraid.
Well, all right. It'll be rough, but we can't waste time talking them into it. The monsoons will be coming in a couple of weeks. It's not the same as climbing Everest. We'll travel light, just the four of us. Set up a base and start hunting. All right with you, fellows?
Yeah, sure.
Nasang?
I will go with you. I am not afraid.
Good. Well, let's take a look at the map. Now, we'll each carry a capacity load. We should be able to make this point below the glacier in 2 days. That's 16,000 feet.
Mm.
And if our abominable snowmen are in the vicinity, we've got 2 weeks to find them.
When do we start?
Tomorrow.
Good.
Well, that's it.
Paul?
Yes, Frank?
One thing. What do the natives mean when they say they don't want any trouble with the things?
Superstition, probably.
Oh, no, sir. It is not superstition. It is because the Yeti are cannibals. That is why the porters are afraid.
The weather turned ugly the day we left the village. A cold Tibetan wind blew down from the west, and with our heavy packs, it took us much longer than we'd thought to arrive at the point just below the Rongbuk Glacier. We set up our camp and made ourselves as comfortable as we could. The next morning wasn't so bad. There was a heavy overcast, a promise of snow, and the peak of Everest looming over us was shrouded in clouds. The four of us sat in the tent looking at our charts and drinking hot tea.
I figure it'd be easiest if we started at the East Glacier. It's only about 3 miles from here, and with the weather as stinking as it is, we won't run too much of a risk. What do you think, Paul?
Well, that sounds all right. What do you say we split up? You and Nasang, Alan and me. We'll work up on either side of the ridge, here. And if we spot any tracks, fire 2 shots. Hmm?
Yeah, good enough.
Now, the big thing, though, no matter what, don't shoot at the thing if you do see it. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
If we lose touch with each other, we'll meet back here at 5. All right, let's get going. We'd left the base at 6 that morning, and the going was rough. Alan was pretty well shot by the time we got to the 17,000-foot mark. He was having a tough time breathing, and the wind had come up again. And with it, a fine, powdery snow that blinded and choked us.
Hey, I gotta take 5.
All right. Here, move over here. Might cut some of the wind.
Oh, that's better.
Oh, we might as well start back for the base. We couldn't see anything in this anyhow.
You know, right now, I don't care whether we do or not.
This is good weather. Wait until the monsoon starts.
No, not me. Oh, I'm cold. I've never been so cold in all my life.
We stayed in the half shelter of an overhang for 10 minutes, and the wind was quieter and the snow had let up. I noticed that the tracks we'd made coming into the shelter were gone now, but we didn't have any worry finding our way back. I figured that Frank and Nassang had met pretty much the same thing on their side of the ridge, and we'd meet them at the base. So Alan and I picked ourselves up and started off.
Boy, I thought I was in pretty good shape, but up here... Boy, I'm nothing. Oh, Paul, I'm tired again.
We'll just take it easy going down. You haven't got frostbite, have you?
No, not yet, but...
What?
The left there.
Yeah.
They're not our tracks, are they?
Not unless you took your boots off on the way up.
Must have... just passed by. It must have seen us.
Yeah. Come on. We were looking at a set of tracks newly made in the fresh snow. And they'd passed so close to our shelter that the thing must have known we were there. They weren't the tracks of a bear or an ape, but more like a splay-footed, naked foot. The tracks of the abominable snowman. We began to follow the tracks, and for a while, perhaps 150 yards, it was easy. And then the thing made a leftward traverse down a deep slope. We could see the prints clearly, angling with a sidestep, as sure-footed as a mountain goat, except that it was walking on 2 legs.
This way, Paul.
Take it easy, Alan.
It's getting steeper. Boy, that thing sure can climb.
Hold up. Alan.
Hold it!
And he dropped out of sight over the lip of the crevasse. We weren't roped together. I got as close as I dared to the edge. The loose snow crumbled away from my outstretched body. And I looked down into the blue-black darkness below, falling away into nothingness. He was gone. Finished. All I could think of was the noise he'd made when he went over. Surprised, angry, then silence. The crevasse might have been 500 feet or 5,000. Snow started to fall again. Big flakes this time and wet. I stood up. And across the gap 20 feet away, I saw the tracks of the thing continuing on and away until they became lost in the blank whiteness of the glacier. It had jumped and landed still upright on the opposite side. I went back to the base. And an hour later, Frank and Nassang returned. I told them, and we were quiet for a long time. Then...
Paul, are we going out again tomorrow?
Why not?
I just wanted to...
We should go back.
It is an omen.
I tell you, he was going too fast. He didn't have a chance to see the crevasse. That's not an omen. It's bad sense.
Meto Kangmi cannot be caught.
We'll catch him.
But there are only three of us. If we had a few more men...
I tell you, the thing was so close that if we'd looked up at the right time, we'd have seen it. You think I'm going to give up now? Next time, we'll get it.
There was no chance to get Alan out, huh?
No.
You think if we went back...
Listen, you think I don't want to? He's gone. I tried, but he's gone.
Okay. Oh, okay. Wish that wind had let up.
Maybe by morning. We'll try again tomorrow. It was cold that night, and somehow colder because Alan was gone. I heard Frank tossing around, and I knew he was thinking about... a body broken and lonely, lost somewhere in a deep and dark place. In the morning, the three of us packed our gear, camera, food. It was a light pack. And we started up again. This time to a crest above the ridge. It was tougher than it looked, and we weren't even halfway up before we had to rest. And as I looked to the west, I saw clouds boiling up. Not white, but somber, threatening. And below... the valley looked grim, ugly gray. And then the sun was gone. And we kept on going up. And then I had a strange feeling. It was nothing I could see, nothing I could hear, only a sensation of being watched, followed. Wait a minute.
See something?
No.
I have felt it too, Sahib.
Something following us?
Yes. It is Meto Kangmi.
How do you know?
It can be nothing else. At this height, there is nothing else that lives.
Maybe it's curious. No, don't turn around, Frank. Listen. When we get up to the crest, you two flop down. Stay in sight of the slope here.
What are you going to do?
Move around the hump and watch. If it thinks we're all together, it may come close enough to give us a chance to get it.
You better watch your step. It looks nasty.
I will. Now, come on. It took us another 15 minutes to get up to the crest, and then Frank and Nassang hunched down to rest. They were in clear view of the slope we just ascended. I moved back out of sight and made my way toward the hump, which backed a long shelf on the north side of the crest. In a couple of minutes, I lost sight of them and of the slope. The wind had increased and the clouds had spread now to become an iron gray canopy over the mountain. It was getting colder again. I don't think it took over 5 minutes to reach my lookout point. And when I did, I had a perfect view of the ground we'd covered. There was nothing there. The men were out of sight. And I waited. A minute. Two. There was nothing. Until... it came, carried on the wind, a cry, and then shots. I scrambled back to where I'd left them. And when I got there, Frank was lying on his back, and I couldn't look at what was left of his face. There were terrible deep rents in his clothing, and he was dead. Nassang lay huddled a few feet beyond, a gun in his hand.
Sir?
What is it? What?
Meto Kangmi came from behind us. Before I could draw the gun, it has killed. Then it sprang at me. It is strong, Sahib, with the strength of 10 men.
All right, can you sit up?
My leg. It struck at me, my leg. Broken. I shot at it, but I missed. It jumped away and was gone.
Okay. We'll have to figure out a way to get you down. We were 4 hours from camp, and with Nassang practically helpless, it could well be 4 days or never. I buried Frank where he was lying, then began to work down the slope. Nassang was in great pain. He half slid and crawled as best he could. That part of it wasn't too bad. Then we were at the bottom and there was a ledge to climb. It took well over 2 hours to do that. And we still had 3 miles of difficult terrain to cover. The stops became more frequent.
Stop. Leave me here. Go back.
No.
My leg is frozen. There is no feeling anymore. I shall not live much longer.
Don't be a fool. After a rest, you'll be able to go on.
Soon the night comes. If we are both caught here, we both die. There will be snow, much snow. Leave me, sir.
No, we're going back together.
Please, let me sleep. Let me sleep here. I cannot go on.
You've got to, Nassang.
No, no more.
The ridge is only about a half mile. From there, it won't be too bad.
No, no, let me stay.
Nassang.
Let me sleep.
No, no, come on, Nassang. Come on, you're not going to sleep.
Sam,
you'll be all right.
Behind you, Sam.
I turned, and for an instant I saw it outlined against the snow, crouching, of medium height. It was covered with thick hair. The face was reddish and bare, a semi-human face, and it was not an ape. The thing made a tremendous leap and was gone, but I'd hit it. I knew I hit it.
But the Kongmi, that was he. Did you kill it?
No, I don't think so.
Then it will be back. It has tasted blood. You must leave me.
No, get up. Get up, come on. Let's go. Nassang!
I am very sorry, sir. Will you ask the Lama to make a prayer for me?
Sure. Sure I will, Nassang, but...
Give my pay to my wife in Darjeeling. I'm sorry, Sahib. I die.
Nassang? Nassang? The darkness came, and with it shadows in the snow. Every hillock, mound became the thing, motionless, waiting. In my mind, I kept seeing it, its long arms, powerful, and the dreadful claws it must have possessed. I carried my gun in my gloved hand, but I knew that I couldn't fire it unless I was barehanded. And that meant my hand would freeze to the gun. And then suddenly, I felt myself slipping. It was a short incline, but when I reached the bottom, the gun was gone. I'd lost it. I've got to find it. I've got to find it. And I saw a glint of metal in the snow 10 feet away. And at the same time, above me at the top of the bank, the thing, it stood swaying a little, looking down at me. I moved slowly, slowly. Inch my way toward the gun. And as I drew closer, I kept my eyes looking up. But it didn't move, only stared down at me. And I thought I saw its little eyes glittering. And I thought, if the gun's frozen now, if it's frozen, doesn't fire. And I was nearer to it, near enough to take off my glove. But that moment in which I'd have to bend to pick it up, that's when it would leap down at me, tear my throat out, tear and... I had the gun and I pulled the trigger. And it lay there, strange and terrifying, its blood staining the snow. And it looked at me. Looked at me. Until the sound died away. It was dead. But the eyes kept on staring. It must have been the shots that loosened the snow and ice on the ridge above. I heard the sound, and I ran. Run! It passed me and swept on down toward the valley, the thunder of it dying in the distance. And when I went back, there was nothing there. It was buried somewhere under tons of snow. I made my way back to the Wrongbook village. I don't remember how. I didn't remember anything for 2 weeks after. But I'm alive. And I'm not going back there again. That's all I know. Or want to know about the abominable snowmen.
Escape has brought you The Abominable Snowman, written and directed by Anthony Ellis, starring William Conrad as Lane. Featured in the cast were Anthony Barrett, High Averback, Jack Crucian, and Edgar Berrier. The special music for Escape was composed and conducted by Leith Stevens. Is the CBS Radio Network.
Escape, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 13th of September, 1956 on CBS. Wrapping up this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeBounier. It's been a pleasure.